Phyllis Bennis, what now in terms of this country's foreign policy, defined as it is so much by the war on terror?
Well, you know, Janine, the big problem we face right now on the question of foreign policy is that we don't really have a clue what a Trump foreign policy will look like. We don't know who will be in charge. We do know that Trump does not have, either for himself or as connected to his party, what they call a deep bench in foreign policy, meaning obvious people who would be assigned to various jobs. The question has emerged, would he rely on corporate officials who negotiate international trade deals or international corporate deals? We simply don't know. We also don't know what Donald Trump stands for on foreign policy. He has said a number of things that people who have fought against wars and occupations for many years would look at and say, wow, that's not so bad. He's said, for example, that we should have better relations with Russia. He said once that the U.S. should be, quote, neutral between Israel and the Palestinians. He said we should say no to nation building, and he opposed the idea of a no-fly zone in Syria. But there's absolutely no reason to think that he's going to stick to those statements. He's made other statements completely opposed to them. Most notably, he said he would tear up the Iran nuclear deal. At various points, he called for nuclear weapons to be expanded, to be available for Saudi Arabia and South Korea, and then disavowed those statements. I think that what we're dealing with here is a situation where he talks about his great slogan, making America great again, and the foreign policy and military part of making America great seems to be going back to an era of what he would consider unchallenged U.S. global hegemony. So it's less about creating a foreign policy that works, that protects people in the U.S. and makes us a good partner internationally. It's less about that than about a foreign policy that will ensure that the U.S. does not have a serious challenger. So I think what we're dealing with is a great deal of uncertainty. The only thing that we know for sure is that social movements are going to be far more important than anyone else. Social movements are going to be more important than who's in the Congress, who's in the White House, who's in the Supreme Court, because that's the only way we're going to have to change history. I think one of the things that we've seen very dangerous in the election process and in the coming Trump presidency is that the movement that rose up around his campaign has within it a really almost fascist core of racism, misogyny, xenophobia, Islamophobia. And this is very dangerous if that movement begins to feel that with Trump in the White House, they somehow have power and impunity from accountability, that they have legitimacy that they should never have had and never deserved, it will be even more dangerous. And so our social movements, I think many of us were already preparing for resisting what we anticipated would be a Clinton administration, saying no honeymoon, no waiting, mobilize immediately a movement against wars and escalation. We're still going to have to do that, but now we're going to have to do that, I think, in the context of a broader resistance movement where motions to work to build movements against wars is going to have to also be movements to defend refugees that are trying to come here as a result of those wars. And it's also going to have to link with movements who are providing the first defense for endangered communities, whether those be immigrant communities, refugees, people of color, Muslim communities, Arabs, women, LGBTQ communities. All of these communities could face serious dangers in the coming period because of that movement that has risen through the campaign process. And our movements to stop wars and create a foreign policy based on diplomacy over war is going to have to be part of those broader movements aimed at protecting those most vulnerable communities.